The matter of State versus Tyrell Lansing. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good afternoon. Allison Coram, Deputy Public Defender on behalf of Tyrell Lansing. Good afternoon, Your Honor. Deanna Kessel, Ashman-Stein, Walden, on behalf of the Association of Criminal Defenders.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Pamela Garth and Logan Knight-Scanlar on behalf of the Center for Integrity and Forensic Science and other.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Michelle Gallagher on behalf of the State.
Welcome, counsel. So this case now, as you all know, appears to us in a slightly different posture than when it began, because the particular case and the issue that it raised, of course, has been resolved. So we'd ask the parties in amici to try to focus on the rule, on its meaning, and identify appropriate factors and safeguards that may be of relevance in future cases. Ms. Coram.
I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
The COVID-19 pandemic fundamentally changed how courts operate. And out of necessity and almost overnight, courts, judges, lawyers became comfortable with virtual platforms like Teams and Zoom. And what started as an emergency solution very quickly became a reliable and effective way of court operations. And that experience led in 2021 to the amendment of Court Rule 1:2-1 to allow for remote testimony upon a showing of good cause and with appropriate safeguards. In this case, however, the appellate division erroneously precluded a critical defense witness from testifying remotely, even though at the time he was unable to appear in person due to his wife's serious medical illness. And in doing so, the appellate division erroneously relied on the PATH 3 factors to import a rigid pre-pandemic test into the court rule's good cause standard. This court should therefore clarify that the good cause determination is not governed by the PATH 3 factors, and that instead, a good cause standard must be applied liberally to allow virtual testimony when there is a substantial reason for the request. Interpreting the court rule's good cause standard through the lens of the PATH 3 factors is wrong for two reasons. First, the PATH 3 analysis is outdated and does not take into account the very significant technological advances that have transformed the reliability and the accessibility of remote testimony. And second, PATH 3 and its factors are based on a different court rule, a more restrictive federal rule that requires compelling circumstances in addition to good cause. I'd like to address both of these points and to also discuss some specific concerns with related to expert witnesses. First, the PATH 3 factors are based on a very different technological moment in our society. And so they do not account for the advancements that have changed the playing field in terms of remote testimony. When PATH 3 was decided, the court rules did not provide for remote testimony. And PATH 3 was based in part on an even more outdated case, Aquamarine Products from 1988, which wasn't even about remote testimony. It was about telephonic testimony. And it was decided decades before today's virtual technology even existed.
But here we have also the Family Practice Committee's 2021 report that specifically talks about how the report itself was drafted once the experience of COVID was already in the process of happening. And it does still acknowledge that in-person testimony is the gold standard preferable to any alternative, correct?
I don't dispute that it is the gold standard, and I think that everyone prefers that their witnesses be present in court to testify. The attorney in this case, that was her preference. What we have is an acknowledgement by the court rule that it's not always possible, and the court rule is an equitable rule intended to promote access to the courts, access to expert witnesses, and it is an acknowledgement that based on our technology, that although in-person testimony is the gold standard, virtual testimony is a completely sufficient, reliable alternative when necessary. And that's the difference between aquamarine, which relied on an exigency standard, and PATH3, which adopted that analysis. They're both based on a premise that we don't have the technology necessary to provide an alternative way to give access to the courts. We do have that technology. And in today's world, people regularly evaluate what they see on video, whether it's through social media, it's news clips, it's in court watching video evidence, or it's in court watching virtual testimony. It's not only the technology that has improved, it's society's comfort level with it, and it's society's adeptness at using it. And the second reason that the PATH3 analysis is contrary to the court rule's good cause standard is because it's based on the federal civil rule, which requires compelling circumstances. And when our New Jersey rule was adopted, that language was specifically omitted. And that's important. And that supports my position that we cannot create a checklist, as the PATH3 factors do, that would allow a court to preclude testimony because one of the factors on the checklist was not established, even if there had been a showing of good cause.
I agree with the ACDL. We're talking about experts that, well, may the government avail itself of this rule.
I'm sorry?
May the state avail itself of this
Yes,
rule.
The state can avail itself of the rule. The rule applies to both, to all parties, all types of witnesses. It does not distinguish. However, the defense has a confrontation right. And that means that if the state avails itself of the rule, it meets the standards for good cause and appropriate safeguards, that testimony still may not be allowed because of confrontation clause implications.
Explain how that would work in practice.
If the state were to make a motion for remote testimony, the court would do an analysis under the rule, determine whether there's good cause and appropriate safeguards. If not, then that's the end of the inquiry. If yes, then the defense at that point may raise a confrontation clause objection. And that's no different than other areas of the law where the defense has certain rights that the state does not have. And that's a reflection of the burden that's on the state and the liberty interest that is at jeopardy for the defendant.
What's an example of a scenario in which the trial court would find that there is good cause to allow the virtual testimony, but that defendant's confrontation rights are not properly addressed or violated?
I think that the defendant's confrontation clause rights are going to trump a finding under the rule. So the only time that a state is going to be able to avail itself of this rule is if the defense consents and waives their confrontation clause rights. Otherwise, I believe that the confrontation clause rights would prevail.
So the state would not be able to avail itself of this rule unless defendant consents.
I think that obviously the parameters of the confrontation clause would have to be decided in another case raising that issue. But my position would be, if I were handling that case, I would say the confrontation clause rights trump the state's ability to be able to do this under the rule.
And presumably the defendant would only consent if it was strategic in the sense that the witness might be less effective on video?
No, I don't think that's true. I think the defense might readily consent if it's a not a significant witness, it's chain of custody, it's something. I think that there could be very many scenarios where the defense would consent, but it would ultimately be the defendant's right to pursue his confrontation clause interests.
So if your position were to prevail in that regard, is there a fairness concern by having only one side being able to make use of this rule?
I think, again, that's just the nature of the criminal system, that there are certain obligations that the state has on it that the defense does not.
Assume that's the case. I'm asking, is there a fairness concern as a result of applying the confrontation clause?
I do not think that there's a fairness concern. I think that it is a reflection of how our system works. I think that there still could be a lot of situations where the defense may consent, but if the defense doesn't, the confrontation clause right would prevail.
Are you aware of any case in which it was a criminal trial before a jury and the defense presented a witness on video where the state objected? Not in only in New Jersey, I mean across the whole country.
Where the defense presented a witness and the state objected?
The rule you're asking for here, where a trial court, whether they found good cause or whether they found good cause and compelling circumstances, depending on which rule applied, any court that has ever allowed the defendant to present a witness virtually at a criminal trial before a jury where the state objected, as they did here.
I'm not aware of any off the top of my head where the state objected, but I know that there are a lot of cases in New Jersey where that has happened when the state consented. This expert in this case testified in 2022 in a murder trial, but the state in that case consented.
Judge Taylor noted in his decision that in his recent experience, I guess during the COVID period when so many proceedings were virtual, he had found that there were technical problems in the courtroom and it was problematic to work with documents particularly in cross-examination where there may not have been documents pre-scanned for purposes of this. I think his comments were along those lines. What is your response to that? Because of course the state has the right to effective cross-examination of any witness, just as the defendant has that right.
So that has not been my understanding of problems that have been faced. I think there are plenty of safeguards that can be put into effect. I think having the documents scanned ahead of time and ready, which is really no different than the obligation to have, if it's a live witness, you need to have the documents there and ready. They can be shared. I'm aware of trials where a witness testifies, an expert witness testifies remotely. And even if the state doesn't want to present all of the documents ahead of time, they can, during the proceeding, email a document right to the expert at that moment. They can pull the document up on a second screen at that moment. I know several courtrooms use two screens so that the witness is unobstructed on a very large screen that would be set up so that it shows the witness from, you know, here up the way you would if they were sitting at a witness stand. That's one screen. Then there's a second screen in the courtroom that either party can pull documents up on to show to a jury, to a judge, to the witness. They can zoom in on that screen. They can stop for a moment to gather whatever document they need, to email it to the witness, to supply it to the court. It has not been my understanding that problems like the type that the judge was anticipating are occurring.
The comments to the rule talk about the notion that good cause will continue to evolve as we in courtrooms experiment with new technology, trying to think around a couple of corners. How do you see that evolution going?
I think it's going to just become easier and easier. If we look back to the beginning of COVID, say in 2020, most people didn't even know what Zoom was. And within weeks, days, we were using it. And now 5 years later, we're very efficiently using it. We're figuring out new ways. I know that they just, there was a case where a judge had some concerns about what the expert would be able to do remotely. So they did a dry run. And the expert demonstrated being able to circle things on the screen for everyone to see, to underline, to annotate. And I think it's just going to continue to become easier and easier as people become more comfortable. Maybe judges that are a little bit reluctant are going to realize that it actually is a reliable alternative.
You think we'll come to a point in which we won't necessarily consider in-person testimony to be the gold standard?
I don't think we'll need to. I already don't think it has to be the gold standard from a technology standpoint. The technology is able to accomplish everything that needs to be accomplished. I think it's more the gold standard because of a preference for how it's always been done, a preference for people being in court all together in one room. And so whether that changes over time, I suppose it could, just as people become more and more accustomed to things not being done that way.
You proffer a substantial reason threshold. Why wouldn't an updated factor threshold, like path reused, and that maybe includes some of the factors that the AG put forward in their brief that's particularized to this situation. Why wouldn't that be better if we really spend some time trying to sort of catch up with where things have evolved and try to come up forth with comprehensive multi-factor tests that the court should look at, rather than just looking at something as simple as substantial reason? Because substantial reason, I tell you, could be anything.
I think the problem with having the factors is it becomes a checklist. And then if there's one or two factors that don't weigh in favor of remote testimony, that's a basis to deny the request when they're at the same time, even though those couple of factors may not have supported remote testimony, there may still have been good cause.
That can be remedied by how that test is qualified by the court.
I think that would go a long way if the court were to say, here are some important considerations, none of which in and of itself is a reason to deny expert testimony. But I think giving the court some examples and some possible considerations is more in line with the flexible standard of what good cause is. I wanted to talk about expert testimony, and this in part goes back to, I think, Your Honor's fairness question and concern over fairness to the state if they're not as equally able to avail themselves of this rule. I'd like to point sort of a counter concern, which is the particular need that the defense has of availing itself of this rule, and that's because of expert testimony. If we impose barriers to virtual testimony, we risk further reducing the number of defense experts able and willing to testify to challenge unreliable evidence in court. And as forensic evidence becomes more and more important and critical in criminal cases, the demand for these highly specialized experts keeps growing. But many of those experts live outside of New Jersey, many outside of the country, and few can or will travel long distances to testify for the defense. And there's a disparity that makes this particularly problematic for the defense. And that's that the state already has ready access to experts in their state labs, through their state police laboratories and their county agencies. The defense does not have that access. The state has built-in network of experts, and the defense does not. And finding someone qualified, conflict-free, willing to testify for the defense, affordable for the defense, and in the case of the public defender's office, someone who is also vendor compliant so that they're qualified to testify for the defense, is a very substantial difficulty. And then to find someone who's local on top of all of those concerns makes it that much more difficult. So allowing remote testimony on a showing of good cause helps level that playing field. It helps make sure that this court, the appellate division, the trial courts have the record they need to evaluate the fairness, the reliability of forensic evidence. And without a rule that will allow us access to defense experts to challenge this evidence, we are increasing the risk of wrongful convictions. And we are putting the defense in a position where they cannot necessarily mount a viable challenge to significant forensic evidence. And so if the appellate division's decision stands, it's only going to make it more difficult for the defense to be able to mount those challenges.
The state points out certain considerations that they say weigh in favor of being cautious about a rule that would allow virtual testimony basically with any reason. And they say those are not only do they have a burden to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal case, but also that because of the double jeopardy clause, they don't have the ability to simply say, you know, let's try again, there was an issue. How should that play into this?
I think that's based on an assumption that virtual testimony is not sufficient. It may not be the gold standard, but we've seen it is sufficient. This court rule is based on an understanding or a premise.
When have we seen it in criminal jury trials? Because criminal jury trials were never virtual under any of the COVID court rules, correct?
Correct. And this is not about having a jury trial virtual. This is about one witness, a witness being able to testify virtually.
So are you agreeing with the AG, sorry, that there is, go ahead. I thought you were making a different point. You're saying the same rule should apply in a criminal jury trial versus a Daubert hearing, but that here the entire trial wouldn't be virtual, just one witness would be testifying.
Correct. Virtually.
But you keep saying that that does happen all the time. But then when I asked, has that happened where the state didn't consent, it seemed like the answer was no.
Well, so I can't say that I'm aware of every case in New Jersey where a party has moved and whether the, I know the case that I mentioned where they practiced and circled all of the, I think that was a Daubert hearing though, not a trial.
Great trial.
But in that case, the judge originally said no and then reconsidered and looked at the technology and the safeguards and then said yes. I know that we had, as I said, this expert testify remotely in a murder trial a couple of years ago. But the state did not object, my understanding was to that. So in terms of giving you an example of a case where the state objected, I don't have one, but I also wouldn't necessarily know what's going on in every single trial region. So it's not necessarily that there hasn't been one, but I don't have an example.
I think if an expert testifies successfully in a pretrial hearing, that would end up being a factor that the court would consider to make it more likely that that expert should be allowed to testify virtually at a trial?
I think that could really lead to a really difficult result where a party would have an expert at the pretrial hearing and then wouldn't have the certainty of knowing whether that expert would then be able to testify at trial. I don't think we need to make a distinction between pretrial and trial in terms of the rule. And I don't think we need to do an entire dry run at a pretrial hearing just to justify someone testifying at trial.
Your point, you're saying that when the court makes the call for pretrial purposes, it should also be making the call for trial purposes, regardless about what happens then at that hearing.
I suppose if something happened at that hearing, that was, I don't know what it would be, but something very unexpected that showed a problem. I'm not saying that the court's hands are tied, but I'm saying I think the typical scenario would be if there's good cause and appropriate safeguards for the pretrial hearing, there is certainly no reason to assume they wouldn't also be for the trial. And it should be the same standard. The rule does not indicate that there is a different standard for pretrial or trial, and nor should there be. Also with the court's questions regarding some of the factors that the state has, or the Attorney General has suggested, I think that a lot of those factors go to the safeguards. And I think that's where good cause is separate from the safeguards. Good cause, we're looking at what is the reason, what is the availability of the witness, why is this request being made? If we get past good cause, then we look at safeguards. And that's when we start looking at things like we can do a dry run, we can have two monitors, we can ask the witness to scan the room so that we see that the witness is alone. We can come up with, you know, and that's something that maybe the court's guidance in that area would be very helpful. The court were to come up with a list of things to say, you know, we need to make sure that we're using the technology to its fullest advantage to make sure that this is going to run as smoothly as possible and remain an efficient and reliable way of testifying in court.
So play this out with me. The court agrees, there's a pretrial hearing, and it's a fiasco. Is that court then bound?
No, if something very unusual happened and there was some very specific problem that couldn't be remedied, I can't off the top of my head think of what that would be, that you couldn't figure out a way to remedy it. But no, I'm not saying the court's bound. If something happened and it was a complete disaster, then the court would have to make a different determination.
What if the judge said, you know, in watching this, I really got a sense that my capacity to judge credibility was compromised. So I'm not as comfortable. What if that happened?
I think you would need a lot more than that. I mean, that's just sort of this value judgment. I mean,
Well, that value judgment is made all the time.
Right. But there would have to be reasons why it was essentially impossible for the judge to not make that determination. And there's not really any support for that if the person is on a screen and they're unobstructed and all the things that I mentioned.
But really, how is that really true? Because when someone is in a courtroom, it is such a controlled environment. We know that the person can't be Googling anything. We know that the person can't be handing notes to someone. When someone's on a screen, just because someone scans the room once doesn't mean you can monitor what is happening in that room at all times. How is it at all consistent to say that being on screen is the same as being in a courtroom, and there would be no way to say that you can't judge credibility on a screen?
I think it's the same as the types of comments that this court made in allowing virtual grand jury selection, right? This court acknowledged we at a certain point have to trust people that they're taking their oath and they're going to do what they're going to do. We scan the room, we tell the witness, you cannot talk to anyone, you cannot have anything else in the room. This court said, we're going to trust grand jurors to do that. And I would
specifically in response to a COVID emergency, correct?
It was, but the language that this court used.
Never put criminal jury trials in that same category.
That is correct. But the language that this court used, I found very compelling, where the court said at a certain point, we have to trust that people are taking an oath and they're going to abide by that oath. If there are additional, though, if there were a particular concern, there's technology, there's ways to address it. Kids take SATs and LSATs remotely now because there is software that can show everything that's going on in the room. So there, if that really were a concern to that level, there are ways to use the technology to assuage the court's concerns.
What other safeguards besides the ones that you mentioned would you recommend?
I think from what I have heard from trial attorneys who have had experience with this, is one of the most important things is to have a dry run so that everyone feels comfortable with the technology. So have the things that I mentioned, the big monitor, the having two monitors. You can have your documents ready. And then once a foundation's laid for the document, it just gets pulled up on that monitor. It can be very seamless and efficient, but sometimes that would take practice. What trial attorneys have said to me is there's often several different ways that you can do things through screen sharing. You could put a document in the chat, or you can email it, or you can screen share it and pull it up on the screen. And a lot of times it's what is the state, the court, the defense most comfortable with. So you do a dry run and you figure out what works the best for the court in that situation.
You mentioned that any factors that you think might be relevant of the AG's factors would really go to safeguards. But as to good cause, is there any role for the reason for the request? And I say that because I think it's the experience of lawyers in the civil world where there's a lot of testimony that's been ASA testimony by videotape, is that that's the default preference. As wonderful as New Jersey is, experts generally don't like to take 2-3 days out of their busy lives to come and travel. And the default preference of, I think the majority of experts, I think it's fair to say, would be to just be at home and testify from there. Is there any room in your view for a consideration as to whether or not there is a legitimate reason, a practical reason that the expert finds it difficult to get to New Jersey to testify?
So there is room for that inquiry into what the expert's reason. There is also
let me interrupt you one second. Would that be in good cause? Because that's not a safeguard. That would be good cause.
Correct. To go to good cause, the reason is relevant to good cause, but so is availability. And the problem is, say for instance, we have for the public defender's office, there is one blood stain pattern analysis expert in the world that will testify for us. We have one. They live in New Zealand, so probably that would meet good cause. But let's say they live in New Jersey and they say, no, we prefer to testify remotely. We're very busy. The only way we can fit this in, we testify remotely. It would be the judge's discretion to decide if that was a sufficient reason. But one thing that I would point out, again, going back to access, is even if that reason doesn't rise in the court's mind that high, that does have to be weighed against the fact that it's one defense expert in the world who can provide that testimony.
So why wouldn't it be helpful going forward? Obviously, this case is resolved, but going forward, for the court to set some factors that apply to the good cause determination and sort of flesh that out beyond the general good cause. It means all, you know, a number of different things in different settings, and also deal with safeguards and create a standard that has some detail to it.
I think that example kind of underscores the point, right? Because you could say a factor is the sufficiency of the reason. But, and maybe that makes sense if the person lives a half hour away and can come testify. But maybe it doesn't make sense if it's the only expert in the world. And the only way this court is going to have the benefit of expert testimony on an issue.
But you're suggesting that the factor doesn't belong in play based on the difference between those two things. But in your illustration, perhaps the judge would say, New Zealand, that's a sufficient reason. In other words, apply the factor, and it might come out differently depending on whether the person is in New Zealand or New Brunswick.
Right. But if the factor is the sufficiency, if one factor is the sufficiency of the proffered reason, in different contexts, a reason might be sufficient enough.
So in this case, we have a proposed factor by the AG that the proponent of the video conferencing technology has been unable, after diligent effort, to procure the physical presence of a witness. Do you oppose that factor?
I do, because of the way that I think it could be applied to require more than good cause, because maybe there's five witnesses who can testify on this for the defense, and the defense chooses one. And then the state says, no, they could have made an effort to procure this other witness, and then they wouldn't have to deal with this first witness's scheduling conflict. And again, I just think it's an example of when you have these hard and fast factors, you're going to elevate the standard above good cause and require the defense to jump through too many hurdles to prove that there was good cause, which is a low standard. This court chose to adopt a court rule that omits a compelling circumstances and contains a phrase that has been used in many different contexts to convey a very liberal, equitable standard.
So tell us in general, what would be sufficient from your perspective?
In terms of what's good cause?
Yeah.
I can give examples of good cause. I think an example of good cause is when the expert is in New Zealand or even...
Let's stay away from the outlandish examples. You're walking into a courtroom and you don't have the New Zealand case.
Okay.
What's a basis for good cause?
I think there was good cause in this case. I think the defense witness was unable due to his own personal circumstances to testify remotely. And yes, he only lived an hour and a half away. Again, if we apply a factor test, that factor is going away against him being able to testify remotely. But the bottom line is that he could not and would not, whether he lived 10 minutes away, he could not and would not be able to testify remotely. And he had a justifiable reason why he needed to.
I think he meant testify in court.
Yeah.
In
person.
And then flip it around. What would be an adequate basis to defeat such a presentation?
I think an example is maybe not even an expert witness, a fact witness who is a half hour away and says, I don't want to come into court today. And the court would have other ways to secure that witness's testimony. And I think the court could say, no, we're not going to allow.
But subpoenas testimony. Play a role in a fact witness.
Right.
I think perhaps the expert is the purest example. As someone who is agreed to take on this responsibility, but is not, in most cases, under subpoena to testify.
So an example of when, for an expert witness, it would not be?
Yeah, if you could.
If there may be a situation where it's an expert in a field where there are many, many experts who are available to testify, the expert lives close by, the expert has no reason that they have offered, and it would not necessarily preclude the defense from being able to obtain an expert. And the defense comes into court and gives no reason for why either that expert has a legitimate reason or why the defense has no other option but to go with that expert, then perhaps it would be within the court's discretion to deny that. And I just want to emphasize—
Can I just ask a background question? It seems like the focus of the argument is how the appellate division's decision and the trial court decision would make things harder in the future than they had been. But I had not understood that there had been, certainly before the rule and even after the rule, a widespread practice of virtual testimony in criminal trials or in Daubert hearings and criminal cases. So when you are talking about how it would make things harder in the future, what is that based on? Was there a reality in which this was happening all of the time? And so the reality was there was virtual testimony all the time, and now all of a sudden this decision is going to cut it off?
No, I would not say, at least from my understanding, that it's widespread, but it certainly is occurring in our courts. And I think the concern is that this case is the concern. And after this case was decided in the appellate division, there is now a published decision imposing this very difficult standard. And so I think that's what raises the concern, is that we now have an appellate division using these seven factors essentially as a checklist and creating a scenario where someone could have good cause but does not satisfy one of those factors and therefore is not allowed to, permitted to testify remotely.
And maybe,
wrap up your argument after this question, please.
When you say it's been happening, would you say that it's been permitted regularly since COVID?
I mean, most of what I know is anecdotal from talking to attorneys in my office. I do think that there are a fair number of cases where the state does not object, and then it does go forward. And, you know, like I said, the murder trial in this case was in 2022, so that this expert testified in. So courts have been doing this for a while.
Just a quick follow-up. Do you know of any other cases that are pending appellate review that have this as an issue where it's
I do not. I know of one that was and then was resolved. Just to conclude, I just want to emphasize two additional points, one of which is specifically when we're talking about expert testimony. And again, there's this concern about fairness to the state that Your Honor's raised, but also competing with that is the fact that it benefits the court to have this testimony. And if the only way to get this testimony is through remote, the shaken baby case that this court heard, expert witnesses, one of those expert witnesses testified remotely. And had that not been an option, this court would have had to make its decision in that case without the benefit of that testimony. And the last point I just want to emphasize is this is all leaving it to the judge's discretion. Judges make these good cause determinations frequently, right? And they make fact-sensitive determinations on how to rule on a particular issue. That's what they do every day. And at the end of the day, this standard, absent rigid factors and just with some examples, some considerations for the courts to consider, puts that discretion with the judges, and that is where it belongs. I'd ask this court to reverse the appellate division's decision and clarify that the rules that rule 1:2-1's good standard must be applied liberally.
Thank you, Ms. Perl. Ms. Castle.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I agree with, my colleague from the Public Defender's Office in terms of her argument that when this court adopted the rule, they did so with the benefit of having experience with COVID. And they did it, and as was noted earlier, the family committee practice submitted a recommendation, and the family committee practice recommended that this court keep the compelling circumstances in the standard. This court chose not to do that, and it made the standard good cause with appropriate safeguards. And we would submit that it should be a flexible standard that is based on the facts of the case, using the trial court's discretion. And while the PATH3 factors and even some of the AG's factors can certainly be a consideration, we also agree that there shouldn't be a rigid test because facts can change, circumstances can change. And we can't sit here today and know every factor that may come before a trial judge. that could give rise to good cause that would benefit the court and the defendant to have testimony before the court, before the fact finder, that if it wasn't allowed to do so remotely, the court, the fact finder might lose that testimony altogether. And when we're looking to have a fair trial for a defendant, when we are looking for the defendant to have every opportunity to present their defense, the ability to have a remote testimony when good cause exists is vitally important. And it is in the best interest of the state as well as the defense, because if the defense asks to have a witness testify remotely and that is denied, and for whatever reason, the defendant cannot get somebody else to testify as to that testimony, then they may have an argument that they did not have a fair trial, they did not have the right to present a full defense, and it goes against fundamental fairness and due process. If the defense asks to have a remote witness testify and it is allowed, it might actually benefit certainty of that conviction if that happens. It may prevent unnecessary delay. It may prevent—
Let me ask you about your comments about the idea of a multi-factor test.
Mm-hmm.
These tests exist in many, many settings in criminal cases. And you use the word rigid test. I think you and your colleague, Ms. Perrone, have really two criticisms of PAT3. One is it's outdated and the other is it's rigid. But multi-factor tests are used all the time, and there's room in those tests for some additional factors that may be relevant for the court's consideration. So what is the negative to giving the court some guidance as to flesh out the meaning of good cause, which may be a really amorphous standard for a court to apply without more guidance?
I don't have any objection. I think having considerations for a trial court to consider can be appropriate, provided that one of those factors would be an open-ended, any other factors that the trial court may deem necessary to consider in the circumstances of that particular case. So it should not be an exhaustive list. And as long as there is guidance that says whatever list or whatever factors we may present is not exhaustive, I agree that it could be very helpful to have a list of considerations that we can think of here today.
And, you know, the AG provides us at page 24 of their brief, any other factors based upon the specific facts and circumstances of the case that a court determines to be relevant. That's the sort of typical last factor you see in these kinds of tests. So if something along those lines were part of it, can you see any negative to having factors for the court to consider?
I would have no objection as long as they are factors to consider and that they are not a test.
There are some extremely gifted cross-examiners who are members of the ACDL that you stand here today representing. Do you think that they would agree that cross-examination being conducted virtually is no different than face-to-face confrontation?
I would not say it's no different, but I do think that given technology and how technology has advanced, it is getting better and better and closer to in-person cross-examination. And I think that the appropriate safeguards that we have in this rule can provide and mitigate those differences. We can have several screens. We can have remote media rooms. If there is one of the concerns that people have discussed in articles about this is, what do you do when you have physical evidence? You have physical evidence you want to present to the witness in cross-examination. If that's the case, the state knows about it ahead of time. If that's the case, and there is good cause to have a remote witness, we can have a remote media room where possibly an officer of the court is, where that piece of evidence that you need to cross-examine about can be in the room with the witness for those questions.
Can you tell us if the ACDL's position would be the same if it were unable to rely on the confrontation clause?
I'm not sure I'm following your question.
Right now, the ACDL could object on confrontational clause grounds,
yes,
to the state invoking this rule and insist on face-to-face confrontation. My question is, if that were not part of the equation, would the ACDL take the same position it takes now?
Meaning that the state would have the same opportunity to cross-examine remotely without the confrontation clause?
Or that the state could
present its own witnesses remotely. Yes. Yeah. It would be the same test for both parties.
I do think that the confrontation clause plays a very large role in how you evaluate this. I also think that there are due process concerns and fairness concerns because we have the defendant's liberty that's at stake. So I do think when it's the state, there is a heightened analysis when you are looking at good cause.
But it seems so contrary to say that both cross-examination can be just as effective and only the defendant should be able to use virtual witnesses and the state never should. If it's just as effective, then why would the same rule not apply to both parties? And if it's not as effective, why can that not be considered in good cause?
Well, I think the defendant has a right to confront its witnesses in person. I do think that there is enough technology that is apparent today that cross-examination can be just as effective. There are mixed findings about that. And we have a constitutional right for the defendant that the state does not have a corresponding right. And so
I understand, and that's why the Chief Justice was asking you, if you could not rely on that right, would you support the same rule for both parties? And it seemed like your answer to that was also no. And so what we're just trying to understand is, if this is such a great system, why is it also not a great system for witnesses for the defense?
I think it is a great system, or can be a great system. If the defendant does not have any Sixth Amendment rights, then I think the analysis is still, it is good cause with appropriate safeguards. But the state has the burden of proof that the defendant doesn't have. And so when you are evaluating good cause, I believe that the state would have a heightened analysis that the trial court would have to undertake to look at whether good cause exists for that state's witness.
But not just asking you, nobody's asking anybody to waive confrontation rights or arguments regarding the burden of proof, et cetera, but just if in theory, and I understand this is a hypothetical, but that's sometimes what we ask, is if in theory this applied to both, would you be supporting it?
I would support that good cause with appropriate standards, appropriate safeguards should be applied to both, although I think the analysis has to be different when it's the state versus the defense in terms of what constitutes good cause, and that comes back to the defendant's constitutional rights.
So we can't get away from that, in other words.
Correct.
So we can't really even get an answer as to what your position would be, because there's reasons why the defense would not want the state to have that opportunity.
That's correct.
Could part of the good cause analysis be, you've given an example where the witness would testify from a safe room where there was an officer of the court present to make sure that the witness was not being coached, was not using their phone to Google answers, et cetera, et cetera. Could that be part of the good cause analysis, meaning the court system now has to expend resources to send a court officer far, far away to sit in a room with the expert, perhaps in New Zealand, instead of the expert testifying in person in New Jersey, so that we can be sure that the expert is not Googling, is not being coached, doesn't have something physically in the room next to them that you wouldn't be able to see on camera, et cetera?
I think that actually goes to the appropriate safeguards as opposed to the good cause. If there is good cause to have a remote witness, then I think you look at what are the appropriate safeguards to make sure that that testimony is reliable and fair.
But my point is, I guess then what goes into whether a safeguard is appropriate? Does the court have to do everything possible, including send someone far away to sit with this witness in a separate room because the witness has health issues and doesn't want to travel to New Jersey?
I think it's going to be up to the trial court's discretion based on the facts of the case. I think each case may present different facts and different factors, and trial courts have to make discretion on testimony and evidentiary issues all the time. And so I would leave it to their discretion to decide if that safeguard is appropriate in a given case.
I don't know the answer to this question, and I'm struggling to recollect, but at the time the court made this change to the rules, it had some family practice guidance recommendations from family practice. Was there a similar series of thoughts and recommendations from the criminal bar?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor.
This specific report, I think, had someone from the Criminal Practice Committee, the Civil Practice Committee, the Family Practice Committee, and one other committee. So I don't think that the report was only, even though it was labeled from the Family Practice Committee, I believe that someone from Criminal Practice and Civil Practice was involved. Is that possible?
That's possible. Thank you, Your Honor.
Or was it the entire committee, do you know, or just an individual?
I'm not aware. I have it at my at the table. I don't have it in front of me.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add?
I think just to sum up, we agree with the flexible standard that's been advocated by the Public Defender's Office. We think that having remote testimony is better than losing the testimony altogether, and that we urge this court to make clear that this is a good cause standard and that it is not the elevated compelling circumstances or exceptional circumstances that the appellate division in the trial court read into this analysis in the Pathrick, in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Barber.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. To be clear, amici agree with defendant's interpretation of Rule 2-1B and its application in this case. However, amici here take a narrower position and argue that under whatever standard the court chooses to apply, when deciding whether an expert can testify virtually at an Olenowski hearing, the availability of other experts is an appropriate factor for the judge to consider. As Ms. Perrone stated earlier, this factor is crucial because the subset of forensic science experts who know the area of science and are both able and willing to work on behalf of defendants is small. Frequently, some of the few experts who meet these criteria live far outside of New Jersey. By contrast, the state often has forensic science experts at their disposal who are readily available. And as Ms. Perrone argued, this imbalance creates a real risk of wrongful convictions. I think it's important to note that none of the Pathry factors squarely address this imbalance of access. And in a world where we know that forensic science has enormous sway over jurors, this imbalance can tip the scales of the justice system. Amici do not take a position on whether the availability of other forensic science experts should be considered when deciding whether an expert can testify virtually at trial, as that presents issues involving credibility that do not exist in the context of assessing reliability. Amici only ask that this factor be considered in the context of Olenowski hearings.
Sometimes, though, analyzing reliability can involve analyzing credibility, right? So sometimes, for example, a court could find that the science is generally reliable, but it is not being reliably applied by this particular expert because this particular expert was not credible in their process or how they were going about it.
Your Honor, so I think the court in Olenowski really stressed that reliability does not turn on witness credibility because the methodology that an expert uses isn't related to the credibility of an individual witness. Your Honor, you're correct when you noted that whether the witness is reliably or is accurately applying that methodology, there could be some component of credibility there. But this court and the judiciary has experience with these types of virtual hearings occurring, and with the safeguards applied, I think a judge can make that determination in the context of an Olenowski hearing.
In an Olenowski hearing, does the defendant have confrontation rights as the defendant would in front of a jury?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor, but I do think that the rule that amici are proposing would apply to both sides.
Would apply to both sides. So I mean, it's Olenowski obviously is as a Daubert hearing is in federal court, as Accutane is in civil, is a the court acting as gatekeeper and assessing the reliability under various factors of a particular expert in order to determine under 702 whether that expert will testify. Is it possible that in that Olenowski setting, we could have a rule that applies equally to both sides?
I do think you could have a rule that applies equally to both sides, but I do think if the availability of an expert to testify in person is not considered, amici would be disproportionately harmed by that factor not being considered because there is a real imbalance in terms of the types of experts who can testify.
In establishing what safeguards are appropriate, would it be appropriate to have the Criminal Practice Committee where all of the different stakeholders are involved, tackle that question, and then have the answer by way of an amendment to the rule.
I think additional input from the criminal bar or criminal practice committee could only be helpful.
I take it your position of this can apply to Lanowski hearings. There's room in that formulation to say, as well as when there is consent on both sides, in a plenary hearing, in a proceeding in front of a jury.
Your Honor, can you repeat that?
Would you add that if both sides agree, jury can get virtual testimony?
In the context of an Lanowski hearing or at trial?
Context of a jury trial, for example.
Amiki, don't take a position on that, but I don't think there's any reason that if both sides agree to it, why a court would find that virtual testimony wouldn't be permissible.
But let me ask a practical question from the point of view of lawyers who have to figure this out and sometimes age in dog years while dealing with experts for various reasons. If in general, would you expect that an Olenowski hearing would be held close to the projected date of trial?
I think it would depend, Your Honor. In some circumstances, that might be true, but in other circumstances, there might be a substantial gap of time. And I think that's one of the reasons why amici are really stressing that this should only apply to Olenowski hearings, because if an expert were to have to come to New Jersey both for an Olenowski hearing and for trial, then as was discussed earlier, this could involve several trips of 2 to 3 days and travel and disruption of the expert's normal activities. So
if you think of how this could play out, the defense has an expert, they takes potentially months to work with the expert, there's just findings by the expert, you get to the Olenowski hearing, there's an issue of travel for the expert. And at the Olenowski hearing, the court is making a determination, is this person allowed to come, or I guess prior to this hearing live or not? And if the answer is no, they must show up live and the expert just can't do it, or for whatever reason it doesn't work out, doesn't the defense have to be scrambling for another expert?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you think of any way that could be dealt with in a way that would work in a fair way to both sides, in terms of advance notice? Should that be a component of the rule?
Well, I do think, Your Honor, that it illustrates the difficulty of the position that many defendants are in, where there's only a handful of experts who could satisfy these criteria. And if an expert on the eve of an Olenowski hearing decides that whether it's the inconvenience or whether it's some type of medical reason precludes them from traveling to New Jersey and testifying in person, defendant is faced with a real difficulty. And Your Honor, I would say that the factor that amici is offering, it recognizes that a hearing where everyone is available to testify in person is superior to a hearing where some people have to testify virtually. But a hearing where there are experts on both sides, even an imperfect adversarial hearing, is superior to a one-sided hearing.
Counselor, can you foresee a scenario in which a co-defendant would have the right to take a position on this issue?
Your Honor, whether a co-defendant would have the right to take a position on whether a defense expert could testify.
The discussion is going on between one defendant and the prosecutor and the judge, and a co-defendant has a position, but perhaps a co-defendant feels prejudiced by testimony that they were relying upon in a certain way, being virtual. Do you think a co-defendant would have a say in this?
I think a co-defendant could certainly make their position known to the court, and the court could consider that. But I do think the court's analysis should consider whether an alternative expert was available for that other defendant.
Other questions, anyone? Thank you, Mr. Carr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Galley?
Chief Justice, Associate Justices, and may it please the court. This case demonstrates why the freewheeling convenience standard that is being requested is inappropriate, because it ignores the case-specific facts each court should consider in determining whether good cause under Rule 121B is met when exercising its discretion to permit remote testimony. Your Honors, this case is moot and should be dismissed as such. However, should this court address it on the merits, it should be affirmed. The motion court here appropriately weighed the considerations within the pathway factors, which the state respectfully submits provide a necessary framework that should not be overruled, but refined for the criminal context, particularly for trials, in light of the highest standard of proof under our law, the double jeopardy clause, credibility determinations that must be made by lay jurors, and the integrity of the proceedings courts are tasked with ensuring. Defendants are not automatically entitled to the best expert of their choice. In fact, our court rules and evidence rules limit experts in various ways. It is similarly appropriate that trial courts should be permitted to exercise their discretion within a suitable framework to determine the means and manner of expert testimony in the context of a specific case within a specific courtroom. In this case, the fact that defendant's expert came in and testified without any of the offered precautions not only mooted the issue here, but demonstrated the appropriateness of the motion court's decision and the pathway framework. Turning to some of the conversations that happened earlier, Chief Justice, you really honed in on the issue here. The fact that the defense is still citing the confrontation clause fundamentally shows that in-person testimony is not the same as remote. If remote testimony and in-person are fundamentally the same, the confrontation clause shouldn't apply because it's essentially the same as being in the courtroom. If that's not the case and that is not the position of the defense and defense-aligned amici, then we have to acknowledge they are not the same. Inherently, they are not the same. It was asserted that Pathry was in a different technological situation here, decided in a different technological age, essentially. It was January of 2020. It was a few months before the COVID-19 pandemic hit. So Skype, Teams, all these things existed. People were somewhat sophisticated. It wasn't as widespread, and certainly the practice proliferated during the pandemic under necessity. But we're not talking about a 1988 case, Aquamarine. And I will say Aquamarine, though it is from quite a few decades ago, one of the inherent issues was telephonic testimony and how do we know that the person on the telephone is the person that we want testifying in court. Here with the advances in technology, generative AI and the like, we might be faced with those risks once again in a new context as tech evolves. So these safeguards are essential. There's good cause and there's safeguards. And Your Honors, I would respectfully request, in addition to the Attorney General's factors to consider, that courts should consider, perhaps the Criminal Practice Committee should be brought in to determine what appropriate safeguards can be laid out for courts. Respectfully, I know there's a conversation about safeguards being left to the discretion of individual courts. That would not be an acceptable standard, so that certain courts would have a threshold for safeguards and other courts would not. We have to have some kind of uniform safeguards in place to ensure the integrity of our proceedings. Moving on to some other points that were made, Justice Patterson, I know you noted the logistical and tech limitations that Judge Taylor brought up in his own courtroom. And perhaps those in this room might not be aware of the tech limitations of certain courtrooms, but certainly different courtrooms have different equipment. They have different standards and access to resources, as do individual litigants. And here the judge was well informed, not just from a prior case where litigants were somewhat hamstringed, or at least there were a lot of logistical issues with cross-examination, but also the judge referenced his regular Monday calendar,
where there are disruptions based on bandwidth, based on who's on the other side of the line. So again, this goes to the safeguards that are in place and whether good cause can be met. Your Honors, also,
are you done with your opening statement?
I am, Your Honor.
Are we really talking about two different issues? And Mr. Garg's presentation made me focus on that because his client, the amicus, is limiting their consideration of the Olenowski hearings. I assume it's your position that there's no such thing as a confrontation right in an Olenowski hearing.
Correct, Your Honor.
So is the issue in the Olenowski setting, which is yet another, you know, hearing before a judge, a 104 hearing in essence, before a judge, really distinct from the trial question here? And is there room in the former setting, in the Olenowski setting, for a rule that applies equally to the state and defendants? I know they've talked about differences in availability. Nevertheless, that's different from a situation where there's a constitutional rule at play.
That would be the state's position, Your Honor, yes.
I heard you argue briefly that this case is moot. I assume that you would continue to argue that, but you just were not doing so because you already argued that in papers and we did not dismiss the appeal. Would you support this court asking the criminal practice committee to opine on whether a different rule should apply in criminal cases, whether there should be one in criminal jury trials versus in Daubert hearings, what type of adequate safeguards might be at play, what type of factors might be involved in a good cause showing, just because a lot of this was not included in the original, the whole committee report in 2021 that made this recommendation on the rule. I think it only had 1.5 pages on this particular rule, and then it moved on to lots and lots of other things. So a lot of this was not aired, at least in the context of the written report, consideration of civil versus criminal, Daubert versus trial, et cetera. Would you support this court making a recommendation to the Criminal Practice Committee to kind of flesh this out?
Yes, Your Honor. And if this court does not dismiss this case as moot, I would urge this court to affirm the lower court's ruling. PATH3 does set an appropriate floor and some kind of framework, and it would provide guidance. This obviously is a matter of public import. We have amici here on both sides. So unless this court is dismissing the case as moot, the state would urge that it be affirmed, that PATH3 should at minimum be the floor here, and refer to the Criminal Practice Committee to further flesh out what appropriate safeguards and what appropriate standards for good cause should be addressed, particularly in the criminal context.
So to deal with not only appropriate safeguards, but to also deal with what good cause means.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes.
And was I correct in understanding that defendant has now pled guilty? So anything the court says about general good cause and appropriate safeguards could not even be used in this case in a trial?
Your Honor, the defendant has pled guilty. However, I did submit an updated letter on Thursday of last week that the defendant did, through counsel, raise an issue that perhaps he would like to withdraw his plea. He was given an opportunity to appear at court on October 29th. He did refuse to come out of his cell. So if, again, he met the Slater factors and he was allowed to withdraw his plea and then we went to trial, perhaps it would not be moot, but that would be a lot of stars would have to align for that to happen in the state's position.
And the Olenowski hearing happened.
Correct, Your Honor. And again, this witness, though he had his purported health concerns and the concerns of his wife, did come in. After the appellate division ruled that he had to come in person, he did come in person, and he did not, to the state's knowledge, take one precaution that was offered to him. So there were precautions offered to him for his health concerns, that he could wear a mask, that protective glass could be put up, that the time in the courtroom could be limited, that his testimony could be confined to one day, that the testimony could be done in a larger courtroom so that the parties could space themselves out and not be in such close proximity.
Do you really think it's appropriate that the court was trying to weigh in and value judge his caretaking responsibilities in this context?
Your Honor, it goes to his difficulty to appearing in person, which is one of the Pathry factors, Pathry factor number 7. And the court did find and say that it believes it was a legitimate concern on his part. However, the court did highlight it wouldn't really be addressed. If he's the primary caretaker, even if he were allowed to testify remotely, he would have to have some other kind of temporary caretaker there to attend to his wife, because he would essentially be on the stand for a period of time. And the court asked, how would this be addressed? Would he be asking for frequent breaks to go attend to his wife? At that time, the trial counsel for the defense said that she could confer with the expert and provide a supplemental certification addressing that. And to the state's knowledge, nothing was provided.
I think Justice Hoffman's question was going towards all the facts that you were just presenting, that he came and he seemed fine. I think that's what Justice Hoffman was referring to. Is it appropriate for us to assess those issues after the determination had already been made that virtual testimony was not going to be allowed and he came in? What happened thereafter, I'm not sure how that is relevant, or we need to consider the fact that he didn't want to wear a mask or didn't want glass in front of him. Is that relevant? I don't think it is.
Well, Your Honor, it's illustrative to granting...
To show that he was not truthful? That's what I'm trying to understand. That sounds like what the argument is that you're making, but...
I apologize, Your Honor. It's not, the state is not arguing that he wasn't being truthful, but it does go to what the state is saying is essentially a convenient standard here. Though it might be onerous on this witness to come and testify, trials are onerous. They are onerous on anyone who has to come in. They are onerous on our jurors who have to come in and leave their families, their jobs. But as a society, we recognize it is important for us to be in person to be able to assess credibility. That is, in fact, the gold standard. That's why we have compulsory subpoena powers. That's why the state or defense can get material witness warrants. So a convenience standard, or as the public defender argued, a substantial reason, quote, like personal circumstances, scheduling conflicts, or travel limitations, the state would submit, and that's on the defense's brief, page 23, the state would submit that does not meet good cause.
Go ahead. If you were still finishing, go ahead.
Just because of the countervailing interest and the importance of in-person proceedings, Your Honor.
Are you aware of any other state or federal court that allows virtual testimony in criminal trials, criminal jury trials, even if the state is opposed?
I am not personally aware of that, Your Honor.
Other questions?
Doesn't the state allow closed circuit? Don't the courts allow state closed circuit testimony in some instances involving victims of sexual assault? The state would be in the position to make a motion that a victim of a sexual assault or a child endangerment testify via closed circuit testimony?
Certainly, Your Honor. And there are obviously hefty concerns for the risk to the witness there and the victim. I will say the difference is that takes place in a courtroom. It is in a courtroom. There are judicial officers present. It is played in the courthouse. Here, what was requested was...
I'm just confirming, because the question was asked, do you know of any time testimony is allowed when, you know, the state doesn't agree, but there are other instances in which testimony closed circuit is allowed, even though it's in a different posture.
Yes, Your Honor. The state is allowed to present child sexual assault victims through closed circuit TV. And there is a case law on that area. However, the state is not aware of a situation where the state objected to a defense's witness or a defense expert testifying remotely, and that was still permitted. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I'm just not aware of it, Your Honor, and I apologize.
Or in theory, the other way, where the state wants to present a witness not in the courthouse via Zoom, and the defendant objects.
Correct. Yes, except for in the case of...
But as you pointed out, that's not the the person who's testifying is still in the courthouse.
Correct. And again, with all the attendant solemnity of the courthouse right. and the protections of the courthouse here, you know, in a courthouse, you have judicial officers, you have both sides, you have the litigants, you have obviously the judge and the jurors. And Pathry acknowledged this, the idea that the very ceremony of trial and the presence of the fact finder may exert a powerful force for truth telling. That's Pathry at 216, quoting the comment to the federal rule of procedure 43A. The
Pathry leaned on aquamarine.
It did.
Aquamarine is a radically different case. I mean, aquamarine is a telephone case in which the court says the witness here was not known to any of the parties, nor was he an officer of any kind, an acknowledged expert, or a witness with a definable official or other special status. He was simply a private person in business in another state with or without an axe to grind. There was no way to ascertain his identity, even to assure that he was who he said he was. That could not be a more different situation than we have now. And yet we are leaning on a case that provided a standard that got that from aquamarine, that got those principles from aquamarine. In fact, it's somewhat ironic that in aquamarine, the court says, hey, why didn't they just do a videotape deposition? So the court is saying, we could have solved this problem, just do it by videotape. And so it feels to me like Pathry is leaning on a precedent that could not be more different than this case.
Your Honor, Pathry does acknowledge and references aquamarine and also Santos, which comes later. However, Pathry takes pains to say that it's in a different posture than those cases were.
Pathry says it's building upon aquamarine.
It does, Your Honor. However, it also acknowledged the advances in technology that have happened and that it was in a different context. And again, Your Honor, going back to the advances in technology that are happening so rapidly, we may have situations with generative AI and the like where in a completely different context, we may not be able to assure who's on the other side of that screen, though it may appear to be the person. There was just a case out of Arizona earlier this year where a murder victim's family used generative AI to create the victim's image to give a victim impact statement. And that AI delivered the victim impact statement, and they used an aging filter to make it look as if he would look had he survived. So again, there are vast concerns here, not just with good cause, but also the procedural safeguards in liberally granting what the defense is asking.
If the judge is using Pathry to determine good cause, which is the most important factor of the seven?
Perhaps, Your Honor, I would say, though the defense characterized this as a checklist, I would say it's for the court to consider all the factors collectively as it did here. However, the difficulty in appearing in person perhaps would be the factor if for some reason it was impossible for the witness to appear for whatever reason, perhaps that would be the most determinative factor. However, the state would submit that court should consider all the factors to the best of their ability, weigh them all together. And perhaps as Amiki has noted and Justice Patterson has noted, just a catch-all can be added at the bottom as the AG urged and cites that Colorado and Iowa have, that the court can consider any other factors that it deems relevant or reasonable.
Questions, any?
Your Honors, I would just say the freewheeling application of good cause is not justified, as this case demonstrates, because it would potentially compromise the integrity of proceedings and improperly put a litigant's convenience above the truth-finding function of our courts. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gallagher. Ms. Dion.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court.
In the event this court finds this case is moot, but the underlying issue is one of significant public importance warranting this court's review, the Attorney General urges this court to clarify that for criminal trials, the good cause needed under Rule 1:2-1B to justify taking testimony from an expert witness remotely should be found only if all parties consent or in exigent circumstances after analysis of criminal and case-specific factors and the imposition of appropriate safeguards.
Sorry, your first line argument is that this case is moot.
Correct.
Okay.
What is your position about Olanowski hearings?
The Attorney General's position is that pretrial hearings, specifically Olanowski or motions to suppress, are different than criminal trials, which are in themselves different than civil. So the Attorney General is really asking for a delineation of this rule, like the COVID court orders breakdown, where it was very clear to delineate family versus civil versus criminal, and then even within criminal, to break out the ones that could be appropriately held virtually or which ones needed consent. So the Attorney General is asking for a framework that followed those orders, that built into this rule what good cause means depends on the context that you're in, and if you are in criminal, if it's pretrial versus trial.
If just one follow-up on that, if there is a separate rule for pretrial hearings, including Olanowski hearings, does the Attorney General contend that what is good for the defendant is also good for the state? In other words, that the same availability and the same limitation should apply to both sides, given the absence of a confrontation clause issue?
Certainly. At pretrial hearings, without all of the constitutional implications that come along with jury trials, the rule should be applied for both parties. And it should be applied less rigorously than the jury trial application for remote testimony of expert witnesses.
So I just want to make sure I understand. Did you say it was consent plus a multi-factor analysis or consent or a multi-factor analysis?
Or really, if both parties consent, the trial judge still has the discretion to determine that expert should not appear. If both parties do not consent, then the trial court must go into an analysis of those factors.
Did you say exceptional circumstances or exigent?
Exigent. I'm sorry if that was not very clear.
And that's in a criminal jury trial?
Correct.
Okay. Did you obviously meant exigent then. What,
I did.
And tell us, put some flesh on that, please.
Absolutely. Going back to Aquamarine, which is, as Justice Hoffman pointed out, an entirely different situation, an entirely different case, but was the bedrock of how we got where we are now. It was what Santos relied on. It is what Pathry then relied on in addition to Santos. All of those predated the rule, correct, but they all note exigency is required. Aquamarine said there needs to be either exigency or consent.
What is meant by exigency in this context?
In this context specifically?
But you're talking about this type of rule.
For defense experts, I think the defendant would be hard-pressed to prove exigency for something he could foresee. So here, where before he was retained, the witness said, I don't believe I'm going to testify in person. That's foreseeable.
What if that's the only expert in the world?
I think that
that's
then
has, just the fact that they would not be able to come to New Jersey.
I think that then has to go into part of the analysis of whether or not good cause is met. However, you also have to make sure there's no gamesmanship. If only certain experts are allowed for whatever reason, funding or in network, out of network, if those experts are limited only to the ones that appear virtually, you just have to have in place rules that make sure that any claims that this is the only witness or one of two witnesses or five witnesses is truthful in the realm of experts. I know defense counsel, the expert reference was blood spatter. There are lots of blood spatter experts. The ones that maybe are best for defense may be more limited, but it can't be limited only to the ones that agree only to appear virtually.
So isn't it Pathry that said, oh, yes it is, that exigency is really the same as good cause and compelling circumstances.
Yes.
Now we know that the rule dropped compelling circumstances, right? And or did not accept introducing compelling circumstances into the analysis. And we know that exigency is based upon a case that, as even you've admitted, is 180 degrees different than this. So I'm not really sure if exigency is the same as compelling circumstances and compelling circumstances were dropped. I'm not entirely sure you're on that strong a foundation to say, but the concept of exigency remains, especially when it rests on a case that is radically different than this one.
Aquamarine was, yes. Santos was not as different, and Santos was more recent. It was post-conviction, but still criminal, so it's a more similar footing than Aquamarine, certainly, which was 180. But Santos also references exigency and is not as dissimilar as Aquamarine was. And as for the notion that in adopting this rule, it was the compelling circumstances language was dropped, I don't know that's accurate, only because that's a federal rule of civil procedure. And I don't know that there's legislative history that the compelling circumstances was considered but not included. Not including language of a civil federal rule doesn't necessarily mean it was rejected. It simply means that it wasn't included at that time. And I think COVID brought out a lot of rules and omnibus orders very quickly to try to keep up with the pandemic. And as the comment to this rule specifies, good cause is going to evolve. And this rule is going to evolve as we continue to delve into what technology is available and which one is appropriate.
One of the things about this case that struck me is that experts and fact witnesses were treated or seem to be being treated similarly. But a fact witness within the confines of New Jersey is subject to a trial subpoena.
Correct.
And has to show up in general and has their potential sanctions for somebody who disregards a trial subpoena. In piecing together what Aquamarine was all about, it was a fact witness, not an expert, in a different state, who in a state court in New Jersey would have to go through. There's a process that you could get somebody, but it's complicated, expensive, and takes time. And so that person could say to New Jersey, "I'm staying in my state, and I'm not coming." Should those situations be viewed in the same way as the issue of experts, who, while there are certain circumstances where some experts may be subpoenaed, for the most part, they come at the behest of the lawyer who's retained them to show up at a given time and testify. So I'm just wondering if apples and oranges are really being considered together here, and if we should even be dealing with fact witnesses.
They are apples and oranges, Your Honor. The question presented was limited to defense expert witness. I think there are a host of additional considerations that would have to go into whether or not it's appropriate for a fact witness to testify remotely. And I don't know that that's been appropriately or even at all briefed in these matters.
But the rule just says, upon application in advance of appearance, unless otherwise provided by statute, the court may permit testimony in open court by contemporaneous transmission from a different location for good cause and with appropriate safeguards, right?
It does.
And so the rule doesn't say anything about civil versus criminal, pretrial versus trial. Presumably it even means trial because it says in open court, but who knows? Expert versus fact witness. It doesn't consider any of this, correct?
Nothing, correct.
So would your recommendation be that we ask the criminal practice committee to take a look at all of the different parts that we have been pulling out in this argument, criminal versus, and we could ask the civil committee also to say civil versus criminal, pretrial versus trial, whether it's a fact witness or an expert witness, to tease out all of the different ways that this rule could apply?
Yes, Your Honor. That would be most appropriate. And if you even look at the subsection before this rule, 1:2-1A, the rule itself is very basic. It's a sentence. But then if you look at the comments to the rule that come after that, it breaks out administrative, it breaks out civil, it breaks out criminal. And then within criminal, it breaks out pretrial and trial. So yes, that's an amalgamation of case law, but that is what the Attorney General is asking for, that delineation within this rule as well.
And here there are no official comments, right? When you referred to comments before, I think that was just from the rule book, not from the court, right? Because I looked at the version of the rule that this court set forth, and it didn't have any comments. And then I looked, as I said, at the family practice recommendation, and it was 1.5 pages as to this rule.
Correct. It is the Pressler unofficial, means nothing precedential to your honors.
And we don't look at them first. It just shows up in.
Correct.
Other questions, anyone? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, your honors.
Ms. Perone, mind if I start with a question that is a thread you've now heard from multiple justices on this issue? We, of course, have an appellate division decision that's published and a case that today is moot. And we're dealing, of course, with a court rule where the court tries to do its best to capture what is the appropriate way to proceed in a matter and makes amendments over time based on developments and changes that we witness. Here, I do not recall that as part of the presentation to the court or its deliberations involved criminal cases, criminal matters, the confrontation clause, and so on. Would it be wise under the circumstances for the court to dismiss this appeal as moot and ask the committees, all the stakeholders, to weigh in on the appropriate questions that have been bandied about and revise the rule as appropriate?
I think it would be appropriate, obviously, for this court to refer it to the criminal practice committee. I would not object to that. My position would be the court should not dismiss it as moot. The court should rule that the appellate division, that it was incorrect, that it applied the incorrect standard, and that it good cause is a very flexible, equitable standard, and that the matter is being referred for further consideration by the committee.
Wouldn't we then just be doing what we'd be asking the committee to do? Wouldn't we be getting out ahead of the very task we are then assigning them to look at?
My understanding of what the court was suggesting it would do is to refer it to stakeholders to weigh in on a lot of the different considerations, what different considerations are relevant, what safeguards are required. But this court could start from the premise of saying, as is indicated in the rule as it exists right now, the standard is good cause. That is a flexible standard. And we are referring for additional input and guidance. If the court dismisses this appeal, then the published appellate division decision, which in my argument is very far afield from what the standard is or should be, would remain the law. And that's what I would suggest this court should not do.
Do you have any argument that the case is not moot?
No, the case is moot. I would like to address one specific thing about the case, because even though it is moot, I think it goes to some of the points that I'm making, and that is this issue over the expert ultimately testifying in person. So the reason that he was able to testify in person is because the litigation over this issue took 2 years. So in May of 2023, his wife was too ill and he could not testify in person. In, I think it was February or March of 2025, when it finally became time for the Olnowski hearing, his situation had changed. And the reason that it's relevant, even though the case is moot, is it underscores the point, no one's goal is to have remote testimony. This is a protection. This is a way to provide access to the courts. But all things being equal, parties, including the defense attorney in this case, want their witnesses in court. The state had said, it's not the same, remote and in court are not the same, and that's an inconsistency in my position. No, I agree, they're not the same. In court is the gold standard. People want their witnesses in court, but remote testimony is a sufficient, reliable substitute, and we have to guarantee access to the courts, particularly to have defense experts available to testify before the courts, and that's why there needs to be a flexible standard. The rule itself is self-regulating. This isn't going to result in defense attorneys playing games. There's no gamesmanship. It's a disadvantage, theoretically, at least, to the defense. If they are wondering, is the jury going to wonder why the state's expert's here and mine isn't? No one chooses that. But if the alternative is to not have your expert or for the court to not have the opportunity to hear an expert, then remote testimony is an adequate sufficient substitute and a standard that's higher than good cause where an overly rigid factor test is going to preclude that possibility to the detriment of defendants and to the detriment of the courts.
In an Olenowski hearing or another pretrial hearing, is there any reason to distinguish between the state and the defense for this purpose? You mentioned that availability is trickier for the defense. I have no doubt that it can be tricky, but the fact is that absent a constitutional right at play, both parties go off and get their experts and do the best they can with to find experts who can potentially assist them. There's no inherent distinction between the two parties in that setting. So should a rule, if ultimately applied in Olenowski hearings, make any distinction between the state and the defendant?
I think the rule is the rule no matter what. And the rule itself is good cause with appropriate safeguards. So the rule shouldn't and doesn't make a distinction, whether it's Olenowski or trial, doesn't make a distinction. It's that the defense has an additional argument that they can make based on the confrontation clause.
Would that apply at a pretrial hearing?
I think it's an unsettled issue. I understand that the parties here were saying that confrontation clause rights do not exist at a pretrial hearing. In other jurisdictions, there seems to be a split over that issue. So I think that that's something that would have to be litigated. I would not concede that it does not apply. It may apply less. I don't know. It would have to be litigated. And if this court were to impose an even lower standard for the reasons that Justice Patterson mentioned for a pretrial hearing, I don't object to that. But the reverse of that, that there should be a higher than good cause standard for trial, I don't think is justified.
Thank you. Thank you to counsel for the helpful arguments this afternoon.